Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Last month, our team brought a live performance of Modern Love to the Hot Docs Podcast Festival in Toronto. Andrew Rannells was there. He's best known for his role in HBO's Girls, and he performed his own essay, "During a Night of Casual Sex, Urgent Messages Go Unanswered." And just a quick warning before you hear this, this particular episode has a lot of explicit language about sex and might not be appropriate for everybody.
Okay. I don't remember his last name. His first name was Brad, which is the perfect name for a relatively faceless memory from your early 20s. He was handsome with a nice smile and startlingly blue eyes. I had always thought that when eyes get too blue, it looks like a person has no soul. It's like you're seeing too deeply into their head and there's nothing back there. But I had never dated anyone with blue eyes, and it was springtime. Brad also had a nice body. He was muscled, but with extremely soft skin. And the sex was good, I think. There's a great debate among straight women and gay men as to what counts as sex. Most of my female friends think that oral sex doesn't count. I disagree. I count it all. If someone has an orgasm, I count it. My female friends also hold a deeper misunderstanding that anal sex for gay men is like a handshake. Newsflash, ladies. Sometimes we don't want to do it with our dates just as much as you don't want to do it with yours. This was only my second date with Brad, and we didn't know each other well. We never would. His haircut was fussy, his hands were a little feminine, but his cologne was appealing. And I was 22 and I hadn't been on many dates, so this is one of my first forays into courtship. And a bonus, he lived just blocks away from me in Astoria. If you've ever lived in Astoria, Queens, you know that getting people to go there at the end of the night is like asking a stranger for a ride to the airport. Brad was gonna do for now. I was young and dating and independent, and I had highlights in my hair. The conversation at dinner was dull, but he laughed at almost everything I said. So for a comedy narcissist like me, he was an ideal companion. As we ate, my Nokia flip phone started ringing. It was my sister Julie. I declined the call. My phone was new, and I was still getting used to it. I didn't love that people could reach me whenever they wanted. I preferred calling my answering service, which made me feel like an old-time movie star. My father had shown me Doris Day movies when I was young, and she was always checking her service for messages from suitors or Hollywood producers. After dinner, we went to a gay bar packed with other gay people on dates, because what's more fun than trying not to look like you're checking out other people while learning about your date's siblings? Brad and I drank our Cosmos. It was 2001. If Carrie Bradshaw was doing it, so was I. Until his eyes looked less soulless, and we started kissing. My phone vibrated again. Different sister, Becky. I ignored it. Another round, more making out, another call, Julie again. My drunkenness mixed with my desire to be present for Brad made these calls easy to dismiss. Our making out turned a corner. We were now prone on a banquette. I had just enough sense to suggest a cab. Feeling like a high roller, I offered to pay. En route to Astoria, there was more groping, more kissing, more picturing him as Paul Walker. At my apartment, we went straight to the bedroom. It lasted longer than it needed to. And then there was the cuddling and the holding and the sweating and the panic and the falling asleep next to a basic stranger and waking up and thinking, do I like this? Does he like this? I excused myself to use the bathroom and I opened my phone again. 6 more missed calls. My stomach dropped. I was now sober enough to know that something was very wrong. I started listening. Julie was in hysterics, something about my dad and falling in an ambulance. In the next message, Becky was calmer but still shaken. It was a heart attack or a stroke, they weren't sure. Next, my mom telling me not to panic. Next, Julie telling me to panic. I skipped to the last message from Doug, my kind of brother-in-law they hadn't married, from just 15 minutes earlier. I called, and he answered immediately. During my niece's first birthday party, my dad collapsed after handing off the hamburgers he had been grilling. The party was at my parents' house, though my dad was not living there. My parents were getting a divorce, and my father, at 61, had moved into a depressing bachelor pad near his office. The last time I was home, a month earlier, I had visited him with my younger sister, Natalie. The walls were beige, and so was the carpet. The furniture he picked out was too large and dark. The place was filled with stuff, yet it looked empty. He was trying to make it a home, but he didn't know how. I went into his bathroom to cry. I didn't want him to see me feeling sorry for him. He didn't belong there. He belonged in his home. I pulled myself together, and we ate sandwiches. He put out plates and napkins and a canister of Pringles. When he opened his kitchen cupboard, I saw that it was stocked with canned stew. I had to clench my jaw to keep from crying again. After dinner, we watched TV. "I want you to feel at home here," he told us. "I should stay here the next time I come to visit," I said, which seemed to make him happy. When Natalie and I left, my dad was standing at the top of his stairs, and I yelled up to him, "I love you, Dad." And that was the last thing I said to him. "I love you too, Andy." And that was it. Doug had tried to do CPR, and the paramedics had used the paddles to get a weak pulse, and now my father was in a coma. I imagined the scene, the party decorations, the yard full of toys, the deck where he fell, the potted plants my mom put out every spring. My mom crying, my sisters crying, the uneaten hamburgers, the little girl's birthday cake. It was all too much. I started to cry loudly. Brad came out to see what was wrong. His hair was mussed, and he was completely nude. He stood in front of me, his semi-erect penis at eye level. Well, I tried to get more information from Doug. And what hospital? Should I get on a plane? I gestured for Brad to sit down, and he started rubbing my back, which felt like torture. I was embarrassed about crying in front of him, but I didn't really care enough to stop. After I hung up, he tried to hug me. "What happened?" I wanted to shout, "Clearly nothing good. Put on some pants." But instead, I tried to explain. As Brad paced the apartment, still naked, suggesting plans of action, I felt a growing sense of disgust. I didn't even like this guy. Why'd I have sex with him? Everything seemed wrong. The apartment seemed cramped and dirty. I hated everything inside of it. I caught myself in the mirror and cringed at my dyed blonde hair. Why did I do that to myself? I look like a fool. I told Brad he should go, that I needed to make some calls. He sat and put his arm around me. "You shouldn't be alone right now," he said, kissing my neck. I leaned into him. I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to be where I was. Everything felt off. Is this how my father felt in that sad apartment? Like everything was off? I kissed Brad lightly. "I really need you to leave." He looked hurt, but he stood up when I did, and then he hugged me for way too long. "Okay," I said. "Goodbye." And then I walked to the bathroom and locked the door. I stared out the window, listening to him get dressed, and then I heard the front door shut. Finally, he was gone. And with a few days, my father was gone too. Over the following months, Brad sent me text messages and a voicemail that went unanswered. I had too much to sort out. I was embarrassed, too, I suppose. About 2 years later, Brad walked past me on 9th Avenue. We almost stopped, but only nodded at each other, smiled awkwardly, and kept going. I felt like I owed him an explanation, some sort of ending to our story, but I couldn't do it. I had to keep moving forward. I had straightened out much of what felt so wrong that night. I now had a job I was proud of, an apartment I was proud of. I had buried my father, and in doing so, I had buried that whole chapter of my life. Which meant there could be no Brad. No trace of that time, of that night. It wasn't generous of me, or kind, but that's what I did. And most importantly, I never got highlights again.
Andrew Rannells, reading his own essay, "During a Night of Casual Sex, Urgent Messages Go Unanswered." More from our live show in Toronto after the break. Welcome back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After he performed, Andrew Rannells sat down with Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, to talk about his piece. And just a reminder once again, there's lots of adult language in this conversation, so it might not be appropriate for everyone.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Well, Dan, here we are.
So who here watched the last season of Girls?
Thank you.
I think that was everybody.
That's very nice. That's very nice.
So that season began with Hannah Horvath publishing a Modern Love column.
It did.
So I'm curious, first of all, if a fictional character publishing a fake column made you feel competitive enough that you wanted to sort of move in on that turf and claim it for yourself.
No, you know, I really, it didn't. I have no beef with Hannah Horvath. No, it was really my friend and my friend Bill Clegg, who was the one who suggested that might be a good fit for some of these pieces. I'd started writing some essays for him. This one in particular, and he suggested it might be right, and I didn't really, I wasn't thinking that big in the moment, and I thought that's probably a little out of my league right now, but you were very generous to welcome me to that column.
By the way, Andrew has just sold a book of his writing, which is, I don't know, is it essays? It's a memoir?
Essays, yeah, similar to what you, I mean, my dad only died once, so that's just one essay. but other things like that. yes, but I sold that to Crown at Random House. So
congratulations! Yeah, when will it be out? You know.
Well, I'm learning. It's a very long process.
It is, yeah.
So I think probably like early 2019 or maybe late 2018.
Cool.
So yeah.
So I want to talk just a little bit about our editorial back and forth. So this piece came in really long. But it didn't read really long because it was so engagingly written and so funny, and so I didn't realize how much work I had cut out for me in cutting it. But
yeah, I think you said you were like, I have to cut 1,000 words.
It was a lot. Like, it was more than that, I think.
Yeah.
But also, this is the clean version that you heard. So there were a lot of there were a lot of bad words in the original version.
Yes, there were.
Do you remember what some of those words were?
Yeah, I think I cursed a lot.
Like what? What was the main word that you just said over and over and over again?
What are you talking about?
Dick.
Oh, dick. There was a lot of dick talk. Yeah, there was a lot of dick and a lot of fuck.
13 times.
13 dicks.
Well,
that's the name of my book.
I just made that up, but there were a lot. I had it was creative editing to figure out how to either cut or, so the Times is a very sort of, you know, it's conservative in the sense that you cannot have profanity, you cannot describe sex scenes and things like that. It's sort of a taste meter. So I've become very good at making the distasteful tasteful.
But the line, the phrase anal sex, that was not an issue.
Those are real words and real acts. And that was fine. We were fine with that. And actually, the semi-erect penis at eye level, that came back to me slightly with a question as whether that was a little in your face, so to speak. But both I and a woman who works with me on the column pushed back and said,
"Thank you."
The whole point of that scene is the glaring sort of contrast of, yeah, that's
yeah.
that happening at that time.
Yeah.
When we had Andrew in the studio to record his podcast version of this, we then asked him all these questions afterwards, and it was kind of really moving hearing you talk about your early relationship with your father,
mm-hmm.
and then your life in New York after his death. Could you just talk about those things?
Yeah, I think that I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and I think that I have an older brother who I think was much closer to my father than I was when we were kids, and which is not uncommon, I suppose, with a lot of dads, or maybe at least dads in the 80s. Like, the little kids, he didn't really want to deal with. So he had, like, me and then my younger sister, and he was like, those kids are too little. So we didn't hang out with him a lot. Then the problem is, at some point, we were not little kids, and we just didn't have a relationship with him. So that was weird, and that continued all through high school for me, that we just weren't close.
But he took you to movies and stuff.
He did show up. Like, that was odd. Not odd, it was great. But he, multiple times, he would call me into the TV room and be like, Andy, I think you might like this. And it would be a Betty Grable movie. It would be like, so he knew. But in his sweet way, he was like, no, come watch the Diamond Horseshoe.
I thought that was such a sweet story when you were talking
about that. Yeah, and we watched a lot of when AMC showed movies. That is how I sort of bonded with him, mm-hmm. is that we would silently watch these old movie musicals together. I remember he showed me Summer Stock with Gene Kelly and Judy Garland. And he knew that's sort of stuff that I was interested in, and he loved, and he was also a huge movie buff himself and loved movies, so we did connect on that level, which was great. And then after moving to New York, that's when I really sort of developed my own relationship with him as an adult, which was amazing, because even though I was very far away from him, we still had, I got to know him more in those last couple of years just over the phone than I ever did living in Omaha. So
that was easier somehow.
It was, yeah. Yeah, I think it was. And it also put the pressure on us talking on the phone. Like, I had to, particularly when my parents started to get divorced, like, if I didn't call him, I wasn't going to hear from him. So I needed to do that. So luckily for me, at the time that he died, we had sort of turned our relationship around and actually had a pretty decent one.
That's very sweet. Thank you very much,
Dan.
Andrew.
Thanks
for great
having
me. Here.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Rannells, speaking with Dan Jones at the Hot Docs Podcast Festival in Toronto last month. Andrew was nominated for a Tony and won a Grammy for his work in the musical The Book of Mormon. You can see him next in Showtime's Ball Street. Next week, part two of our live show in Toronto, featuring Paul Sun-Hyung Lee from the CBC comedy Kim's Convenience. He shares the story of a couple trying their best to get pregnant.
My wife and I were married in our late 30s, hence our urgency. As a bachelor, I never imagined marriage would one day lead me to a small room in a medical office that contained a plastic specimen cup, a sink, a chair, a TV, and a DVD entitled Young and Horny. A sticker on the DVD read, Property of Fertility Clinic. Please do not remove.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Special thanks to Andrew Rannells, Paul Sun-Hyung Lee, and Helene Joy for performing. Thanks as well to the team at Hot Docs. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.